This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Makeba Wilborn knows the art of code switching. As the daughter of a white mother from Ohio and a black father from Texas, she quickly learned to change the way she spoke to each side of her family. Makeba Wilborn mastered the art of code switching as she got older in order to succeed as a biracial woman. Today, Makeba is learning more about the science of code switching. She's a Duke University psychology professor who studies how children from different socioeconomic and racial backgrounds might develop those language differences and how the earliest stages of childhood development might give us an insight into racial bias. Makeba Wilborn leads the Wilborn Infant Lab at Duke University and joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
I want to talk to you. Yeah, I have you back because we've had you on the program before talking about your expertise, and I want to get into the science, but I think so much of your background illuminates this and perhaps is why you got into it. So tell us more. Your mother from Ohio. You're born and grew up in Long Beach, California. Describe your upbringing.
Well, you know, Long Beach is a very special and unique place, especially being just an offshoot of L.A. We take pride in having a little more urban grit. And I always joke with my students, I think one of the things that my undergrads are most impressed with when I talk to them about my background is that I went to middle school with Snoop Dogg.
You did?
I did, yes. And yes, I knew him. And it's funny when you say you're from Long Beach and people say, oh, you know Snoop Dogg. And then you have to say, well, yes, actually, I did go to middle school. He was great. He was a really fun guy. But Long Beach was... The time I was being raised in Long Beach was a very unique place. There were not other biracial kids. In total, my entire high school, there were two of us, another girl. We always got mixed up. And even though in the West it took pride in being progressive racially, it really wasn't. It just wasn't as explicit. But there were definitely times where how I looked would stop people. People were fascinated with what a black person and a white person sort of created together. And, you know, I was raised in the 70s and 80s, and this was not common. So there were definite times growing up as a young child where going through the grocery store, watching people's reaction to me, people stopping and, like, looking. And it wasn't a negative. It was this kind of fascination. And there was at times sort of an uncomfortable admiration, this awe of the blending of these two features. And so early on, I learned as a biracial child that the way I looked really was heavily, you know, impactful in how people sort of approached and viewed me and thought about me and the stereotypes that they would have. There was always discussion about my hair. Well, you have a black nose or your hair's black. There was always this sort of trying to make sense of it. And I realized young that people were trying to figure out how to predict my behavior. Mm. And one of the things that often was mentioned, I was raised by my white mother in a middle class. I argue just middle class. I have an older white sister. So I was really socially raised in an all white environment and largely all white schools. But talking white, oh, you talk like a white girl, or when I would open my mouth, because phenotypically I definitely look other. I don't pass. There's not like you would look at me and not, there's a clear, like you're something. And when I would open my mouth, that notion of, oh, that surprise, and that was from multiple racial groups. So white racial group, black racial group, the notion that I didn't sound the way they expected. Comments growing up like, oh, well, you're not really black. That was always one of my favorites. And early on, that was, how do you deal with that? And then the famous, every biracial kid across the country will flinch of, what are you? And so for me growing up at the time, there was Sherry Belafonte. She was the one famous biracial star. And there was a woman by the name of Jackie Kennedy. She was like an anchor, a news reporter, and not the Jackie Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Yeah. And so that was hard for a kid to try to figure out who they were and where they fit when you didn't sort of see yourself anywhere else.
And that's your quandary as you fathom and detect sort of what the objective view of you is, what the outside is looking at. From your point of view, having to navigate two worlds, there was a kind of talking white and a talking black, if you will.
Oh.
And you can correct me on that.
Oh, yes, without question. I often talk about this. With my mom, there were specific rules. For example, you know, you had to be in when the streetlights came on, sort of thing. And I did not live and was not raised with my father, and I would visit my black side periodically. And navigating those two different households, and definitely it was also economic differences. I was in largely a middle-class environment with my mom, and it was definitely a lower-income environment with my father. But things like eye contact, for example, you know, I would get in trouble. I was riding my bike. I was supposed to be home before the streetlights were on. And with my mother, when I would walk in, it was, you know, why were you late? And I had to have a story. Well, my tire, I got a flat tire. I was bleeding from my eye. And, you know, so the whole ride home, knowing I was going to get in trouble, I was coming up with the story. And I had to really look at her in the face. And if I didn't, she would say things like, you know, look at me when I'm talking to you. And I realized that with my mother, I had to look her in the face and I had to have this story. Where with my black father, when I would come home and get in trouble, it was, you know, why were you late? Well, Dad, oh, don't you backtalk me, girl, you ain't grown. Okay, so it was really a rhetoric question. There's really no excuse ever for why you were late. And also I learned that I had to divert my eyes as a sign of respect. Don't you eyeball me, girl, you ain't grown. And I realized that for my mother, if I didn't look at her, it was viewed as deception. So, right, what do we do if in white socialized environment, eye contact means I'm telling you the truth. But with my black family, eye contact was a sign of disrespect. And I only had to make that mistake once. Eyeball Dad and look away from Mom. And I realized that I had to learn that really quick.
So were you able to navigate that kind of transparently? You just kind of always knew which environment you were in. You didn't have to think about it, or did you?
You know, I would say there wasn't an explicit knowledge of it until I was much, much older. It was really, you know, look, survival. I was figuring out what I could get away with and what I couldn't as a kid. And, you know, when it came to language, one of the things I remember explicitly, two things, my gesture and language were evaluated differently. So, for example, with language, if my father would say, you know, I'm fitting to go to the store, they would call me Kiba. I'm fitting to go to the store, Kiba, you want some? If I answered back, yes, father, I would love to have, he would look at me with that face like, why are you talking to me this way? So, nah, Pop, I'm good. That tone, where with my mother, if I said, Mom, I'm fitting to go to a friend, she'd say, excuse me, you're about to go. Because the sign of connection, when I modulated my tone, my behaviors, and the way I spoke when I was with my families, because that was the sign of connection. If I said, Mama, come on in here, to my white mother, she would have looked at me like I slapped her. And so for me, I realized that I was modulating both my behavior orally, but also nonverbally. My gestures were often interpreted very differently. Family functions with my white family, I often was loud, right, in their mind, because I gesture a lot and I study gesture, and I don't know which one came first. I study it because I do it, or I do it more because I study it. But my white family often perceived my nonverbals as being sort of loud or aggressive or angry, or where my black family would often, you know, if I didn't gesture enough, what's wrong? You depressed? Or you're not committed? You're not connected to the conversation? So it took me, you just have to make a few social mistakes.
Right.
But learning that my gesture and animated, and what I learned was in my black family, it's not what you said, it's how you said it. And with my white family, it's really about what you said. And learning to navigate those two things, even though we were speaking the same language and arguably had the same vocabulary, how language was both used, interpreted as a sign of connection and relationship was very, very different.
When you say learn, clearly this is what you study now. This is the source of your research and the foundation of your research. But when you say learn back then, were you simply internalizing it, or how much of it were you sort of aware of the fact that you had to make these changes?
As a biracial kid, the reason why I think I was so aware of it is that it was often explicitly discussed, whether it be teased and the teasing was not traumatic. It was just a signal that somehow in this context, I have not modulated my behavior in such a way that I'm violating some sort of social norm or some sort of cultural practice that I may not have exposure to or know. And so as a biracial kid, because my phenotype and my race was something that was sort of game for open conversation, I think I got explicit feedback because, and I was also given a pass because I straddled these two cultures. The expectation that I was going to make mistakes was sort of a pass. And so the explicit nature of the external feedback shaped my behavior without question. I internalized it at the time. And it was, you know, look, it was a challenge at times to find your place and to feel like you fit. But now what I realize is that I am now able to look at the process in an explicit way, navigating the two cultures and understanding the differences and what skills I needed and how to acquire them to succeed and be competent in both of those communities. I wasn't being explicitly told, you have to do this here and that there. I had to learn by making the mistakes.
We'll talk more about the impact that has on individuals who have to navigate worlds like that, and also on the outside, what it means for law enforcement, for teaching and education to be aware of these differences and how to navigate those with students and people who are part of our citizenry here in what is still at the moment, a multicultural society. Talking to Makeba Wilborn, a psychology professor at Duke University, studies the origins of language and gesture, and our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking this hour with Makeba Wilborn. She is the recipient of an award by President Obama, an early career award for scientists and engineers. She received that, and she is also at Duke University, where she studies early childhood education and the development of gestures and language. And, you know, we were talking about code switching before the break, and certainly your personal experience. And I think just to give us all an idea what's going on, I mean, clearly we're familiar with this. If you think about, sort of the Key and Peele creation of Luther, who is the anger translator for President Obama, let's get a sample of what it is that we're talking about.
To the governments of Iran and North Korea, we once again urge you to discontinue your uranium enrichment program.
Hey, Mahmoud, Kim Jong, I think I already done told both y'all, 86 your shit, I'm gonna come over there and do it for y'all. Please test me and see what happens.
All right, it's comedians Key and Peele. So what's going on there? Why was that so successful? Why do we get that?
Well, especially because President Obama is a biracial individual. His mannerisms, his tone, his dialect, his behavior was always viewed through multiple lenses. The idea that he has this sort of inner black man that he constrains or inhibits in order to become more politically correct and comfortable for the white America. But I always joke about Obama's gait, how he walked after his second when he was reelected and left the Rose Garden. We always joked among my friends and peers, but he had the brother gait. The first time he won, he sort of walked back. The second time, there was a little bit of a swag and a strut because the notion that he was sort of allowed to have his inner brother come out that early on, that would be fearful. So I think that was always part of the idea in the dialogue. But I think at the lowest level, what it's tapping into is that when you're an other, especially in a country that like ours, you have to switch and modulate your behavior, sometimes your tone, the type of words you use, in order to be socially appropriate and connect. And that was Obama's goal, was to connect and get his message across. And he navigated and switched his behaviors and manners in such a way in order to best deliver that. That's what biracial kids do.
So we can understand that from the point of view of Barack Obama or anyone in the situation where they're having to go back and forth. They become and frankly, we all do it. We
yes,
all have different
we
tones.
We all do.
I talk one way in the office, I talk one way on the radio, and then there's my kids and my grandparents and all of that. So we get that at some level. But I wonder if there isn't something, so there's something instructive in that piece that we just played. Mm-hmm. We get to see, you know, maybe a little bit of what that might be like. Is it offensive in any way? Because I'm thinking, in order to characterize the inner black man, we also have this hyper-aggressiveness and hyper-kind of threatening masculinity, which is the stereotype.
Of course.
That I think is leading to so much of the trouble.
You know, I think with anything, we can look at the underlying, you know, what was the goal of that clip. And it's funny, and I think there's some accuracy. And, you know, President Obama would always get sort of criticized when he would go and give talks at HBCUs for, quote unquote, talking blacker. The problem is, while it's funny, that clip really epitomizes the stereotype that we have. So it's exaggerated, and which I think it inadvertently confirms that idea that there's a fear that Barack has to be less black or act less black, because if not, that's scary. And that's so it's a double-edged sword. While it's funny, it also in some ways communicates that, yes, we should be scared of that, or that to be successful as a black person in the U.S., you can't act, quote unquote, black. And that's because we have a narrow view of what blackness really means.
I want to talk more about your education and then get right into your work, because, again, some of this illustrates what we've been talking about. You went to Cal State Fullerton for college and then Cornell for your Ph.D. What happened when you arrived at Cornell?
As a first-generation college kid, navigating college was incredible in terms of a learning experience. It was also terrifying. You know, I tell sometimes my students I made the mistake, and I think this is a rookie mistake. A lot of first gens do this, is that I got a Discover credit card at Cal State Fullerton. In the quad, they had set up a little table and they were signing everyone up. And I signed up and I got my first card and I felt really proud of myself. And I walked over and I literally charged tuition for the next year. And in my mind, that was genius, because it's better than those student loans. And the card was in my name. Yeah, 29% interest. I made the best decision I could, but I had limited access. There wasn't a clear path. And so going to Cornell, I remember explicitly feeling, you know, the Ivy Leagues. And my first 2 weeks there, the campus is extraordinary. There's really no comparison in terms of beauty. And I remember walking down and looking at the famous clock tower, and back then we had payphones, and I called my mom, and I remember telling her, crying, I said, "Do you think they're going to make me leave? Like, this is a mistake." Because, you know, there's this notion that this isn't really meant for me, or this is a mistake. But culturally, I had both the East Coast, the West Coast. That was a whole different culture shock. But just even going from Cal State Fullerton, which arguably some of the most incredible faculty and experiences I've had in my life have been there, but then going to this Ivy League, it was all confounded. And my race, being one of the only students of color in my department in that program, there was a lot going on there. And again, that notion of, is this real? Or one day are they going to wake up and say, oop, we made a mistake? Or so it took me probably until the end of my first year in grad work to realize that I actually belonged there. And what was hugely fundamental was that my advisor was a woman of color. She was a Latina. And that helped a lot. I could go in and talk to her about what it was like to be the only in a room. And that played a huge role in helping me navigate through definitely the first few years.
Let's talk a little bit about your research. You focus on infants and how they develop language and cognition. Why did you decide to go all the way back to infancy?
Actually, that was the starting point for me. So early on, having gone to what are called PWIs, or predominantly white institutions, when you don't have when there aren't faculty of color, often there is a stigma with studying a quote-unquote narrow group. And in fact, I remember being explicitly told early on, go ahead and establish yourself as a solid developmental psychologist first, then go ahead and study, you know, implying that folks who study a particular racial ethnic group are not sort of these. And at the time, you know, I was just getting training in early language and cognition and infant development, and I was fascinated by it. And the reality is, when you looked at the literature, 90% of it was on middle-class white kids. It's called the weird problem, right? So Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. So I didn't have access. And then the literature that was specifically focusing on different cultural and ethnic groups was often not done in experimental settings or in the same way. It had more of a sociological or anthropological. So I was sort of reading that on my spare time and enjoying that and then being trained. So the infant vocabulary and language development really was where I started. I didn't at the time think that my racial and ethnic experiences or background was playing any role at all in my research. It was sort of separate. And it wasn't until I got into Cornell and I started thinking about early vocabulary building and development with babies and how vocabulary plays this huge role in basically every facet of learning, then this notion of the achievement gap, the 30 million word gap, Hart and Risley's paper, I started thinking about why there were clear disparities in African-American children's early vocabulary and white children, regardless of socioeconomic status. And that's when I triggered all of my code switching and all of my experiences to think about, this isn't always about economics. Often this is about different cultures. It's not a deficit. It's actually just a difference. And this may be driving why the vocabulary building in one group looks slower or quote unquote delayed compared to another.
Well, and forgive me, but it's also not only about verbal vocabulary. Gesture is a very important part of your research. Tell us about that.
So there's a well-established finding in the literature that the more a baby points, more gesture early on predicts larger vocabulary later. This has been well documented. And then the literature that looks at cultural differences, so a prominent researcher, Wade Boykin, at Howard, has argued often that the Black community nonverbal is highly emphasized and, in fact, valued more, and that there's this thing called the verve. It's this overall sort of essence of the way communication. And in the Black community, Wade argues that it's about nonverbal and the way you communicate using gesture and movement. So I was reading this literature, and it appeared that there's a paradox. So if you were to say, do you think Black people gesture more? I don't think anyone would throw their hands up and say, oh, my gosh, that's ridiculous. In fact, it hasn't been documented yet. My colleague, Dr. Sarah Gaither, and I are working on actually putting that in writing in the literature. But then this paradox. So if the Black community is using more nonverbal and arguably gesturing more, then the paradox is that why is that not translating into greater vocabulary gains for Black children? And that really is what led me to write the grant and get funded and do the work to look at these mechanisms. How do babies actually acquire vocabulary? What are the skills they use? And how does their gesture and mom's gesture or caregiver's gestures play a role in that? And then how does that differ as a function of culture? So what are the types of gestures or what are the types of language that's being used in Black families, regardless of socioeconomic status? And what are the types of gestures and language being used in middle-class families, regardless of race? And trying to pull apart and disentangle those two to figure out what is the best way to help facilitate early vocabulary development for all racial and ethnic groups that are grounded in culturally specific ways that parents are talking and interacting both verbally and nonverbally.
So what are you finding?
So far, we're in the early stages. As doing this kind of work is what I call depth research as opposed to breadth. Colleagues over at UNC, the School of Ed, Dr. Lynn Vernon-Fagans, has long found that Black mothers, for example, talk more about emotion, abstract concepts, respect, authority, wisdom, kindness. And the type of language is often more declarative. Sit still, don't fidget, put your hands on your lap. The difference is that type of language doesn't translate into the way we currently assess vocabulary. In Western white America, we are very noun-focused. And so, for example, in one of the tasks we have a picture book task, and we look at the way moms are interacting with their children. And what we're finding, and this is very preliminary, is that often white mothers will label more. They'll focus more on the C in the word cat, and they'll focus more on labeling the objects. Preliminary data appears that what we're seeing, and we haven't collected enough of the African-American population yet, is that often if a baby points and the mom says, oh, it's a ball, versus the mom baby pointing and the mom saying, oh, it's cute, you have one of those at home. Now, both mothers are responding and sensitive to their children. What we do know is that often African-American moms view picture book reading as social, emotional connection. Mm. And it's about teaching social moral lessons, like you better not come in the house with dirty feet. It's not tied to the story per se, where often we find, and this has been established in literature, that white moms are more focused on the text itself. So for us, we're trying to pull apart what we're seeing is that it's not about deficit, it's difference. And if a mom's talking about social moral lessons, that's not mapping onto the way, unfortunately, the way we measure a vocabulary, which is noun-based.
So that would have implications not only for testing and the way we design the test, but also for classroom work, teachers, what they need to know about what they're looking at and how they're assessing their students. How they're assessing their students, but also how they teach.
Without question. I was fortunate to be part of the North Carolina group, State Department of Instruction's group of faculty working with Ken Dodge and folks over at the Center on Child Family Policy on K-2 formative assessment. And we sat and debated a lot because right now teachers don't have a way, especially at the kindergarten K-6 or 5, they don't have a way of assessing actual vocabulary. We do it through literacy. So, for example, you'd ask a child, which one is the word cat, as opposed to assessing the concept of cat. And this was something that I was, you know, very strong in my opinion, that we don't assess both nonverbal and verbal vocabulary in the elementary age and even through third grade, because the notion is, well, we should be assessing reading. But what we know is if you and I were to try to learn a new language, I can read Spanish fluently. Mm-hmm. I don't have a clue as to what any of those words are. And so vocabulary, and I'm talking receptive vocabulary, the amount of words that I have a label that maps onto a concept is often largely ignored. But what's the first thing that happens when a high school student wants to get ready for the SAT? They start flipping vocabulary.
Well, so on one hand, again, assessment. On the other hand, I'm trying to imagine in the classroom, again, it's one thing for a student to be able to code switch and realize their environment and navigate those. But if you've got, you know, 30 students, 25 students, and they're all from different backgrounds, what do I do as a teacher to try to come across knowing that there are these various ways that I'm being received?
Yeah. Look, I will tell you, what teachers do, they are really the capeless heroes without question. I always am very hesitant to say what I think teachers should do because I couldn't do what they do. They have a skill that's absolutely incredible. One of the recommendations that I'll give teachers when I am asked is that we often make assumptions that kids are either at the similar level, and if a kid is not, that it's they need remediation. And one of the arguments I make is, for example, the word flamingo. If you go into some of the lower income schools, especially in Durham, if you haven't grown up in Florida and if you didn't grow, you're not around and raised reading books about flamingos, how would we expect a child to know that? Another example is, and one of a partner of mine in education, a good colleague and friend who's a principal, said sometimes she had a student who was reading the word shrub, and she looked at and she said, what's a shrub? And the educator said, well, it's a bush. You know, if you go into inner city parts or, you know, shrubs, who's talking about a shrub? Right. And so the notion that
the president of the United States, who knew?
Right. So the notion that we all come in with the same worldview and exposure. So I think that's the first step, is just to realize that there's diversity in terms of what kids have exposure to, and that to take an extra minute to say, does everyone know what this word means and to define it, as opposed to just focusing on what it looks like with letters.
So you describe code switching itself, and I'm going to go back and forth now. I'm taking a look at the objective view. What do we do as teachers, as people in the public sphere, understanding this as our consciousness is raised and expanded? I'm going back to the individual who does this. Does this take a toll on people who have to sort of figure out, even if it's subconsciously, if you're not paying too much attention to it, kind of where you are and who you're talking to?
You know, I mean, I think when if we were to have this discussion about bilinguals, I think all of us would say, you know, a bilingual who's switching in and out and going back and forth between Spanish and English or Chinese and English, that, yeah, they're allocating these cognitive resources, this meta-awareness to how they're navigating this situation and what, and we know it can be exhausting. And I think that's one of the problems, is that we view it always about switching languages as opposed to the context switching. So I would argue that, yeah, I think for some, especially kids, it can be taxing, especially if you're quote unquote doing it wrong. And the difference is with a Spanish English bilingual, for example, if I use the wrong word or if I, the correction is often soft and it's, well, I don't expect you to know this. But with a child who's speaking English, but not code switching in terms of tone, manner, and let's say the type of word that they choose or how they pronounce it, it's often this sort of disgust look or the sad look, like you're not enough. And that's, I think, the bigger problem.
We're going to take a break right now. I'm talking to Makeba Wilborn, who is my guest this hour, leader of the Wilborn Infant Lab at Duke University and recipient of President Obama's Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers. And our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to Makeba Wilborn today, a psychology professor at Duke University, talking about the science of code switching. I think a pretty good example of this came a couple of years ago in the world of football, when we were talking about pro football player Richard Sherman, right? And maybe what we should do is talk a little bit about the case and remind everybody what happened when, after winning the NFC Championship game, he was interviewed right there on the field, and what he said and how he said it kind of blew up, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the reporter put a microphone, and he, you know, he responded, and he was competitive, and his tone, his dialect was definitely, quote-unquote, blacker. And also the content of what he was talking about. So-and-so is not being very good. So that violated, right, this notion. But
yeah, well, and I want to get into some of the specifics, because I think we'll play the clip here. But just so you understand, he's a defender, right? His whole job is to make sure you don't catch a pass. And the guy he was working with on the other side of the ball was a guy named Michael Crabtree. His job is to catch passes. Mm-hmm. And that would be just fine, except it turns out that Richard Sherman didn't have much respect for him. Richard Sherman won. He won the battle all day long on the field. And then he's asked about a particular play that was quite stunning on his part immediately after winning a championship football game.
Richard, let me ask you the final play. Take me through it.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get. Don't you ever talk about me.
Who was talking about you?
Crabtree, don't you open your mouth about the best. I'm going to set it for you real quick. L.O.B.
All right, and Joe, back over to you.
Right away, Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman subsequently called the rant heard round the world. For the record, in my opinion, Michael Crabtree is a sorry receiver. But that's not the point here, how he came across. And again, rant heard round the world. This was talked about for a long time.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, they were going back and forth, bragging, boasting, and which is – there's three actual contexts there. You have the context of both the racial context, but also the context of – on a football field. That going back and forth, that banter, that you aren't this, you aren't that, that's completely appropriate and par for the course as football players go. And so the reason why I use Richard Sherman as an example, because this is a man who graduated from Stanford. And if you watch or listen to him in any interview, he code switches in that the way he interacts when he's with his teammates and his players is completely appropriate and competent, and in fact needed and necessary for success in that context. But when you are then giving an interview or having a conversation with someone, an interviewer, that tone, the type of words, the language, the mannerisms has different meaning and value. And he just didn't have a chance to switch before the microphone was in his mouth. And we see what the consequences were for making that social violation.
Just to give you a sense of what that means to be in a different environment, here again is Richard Sherman talking about his work ethic. Let's listen.
So I sit there in my bed and go through film all day. Can't be out there partying and think you're going to be the best. It takes discipline on and off the field. You might play well, you might, you know, make some plays, but you're not making all the plays you could have made. I feel like I'm a decent athlete, but my tape study and my meticulous attention to detail are what makes me a good ball player.
Yep. Dictate it. Dictate what they're going to do. That's what you used to do. That's what you're about to do again. Because then you ain't never worried about a fade because you know when they're running it. They like, oh, gotta go. Me too. Me too. Oh, you going there? Me too. I'll see you. See you at the promised land.
The red zone is tougher because everything happens so quick. And man, they can pick you off and score a touchdown in a flash.
So we got a rare example of the interview, right, intercut with his on-field banter with his players, and there you have it.
And, I often will use this clip when I'm giving a talk at a local school because I will say, if anything, he is absolutely showing what a savvy, skilled communicator does. You could clearly tell when he's interviewing, and my favorite is the meticulous attention to detail. I mean, it's so nerdy. I love it. And then when he's on the field, his tone, his cadence, the mannerisms. And this is someone who is switching and modulating his behavior, which is still a reflection of who he is, to succeed. And if can you imagine if he talked about his meticulous attention to detail to his O-linemen? I mean, they would look at him, what are you talking about? And it's because he's successfully navigating very different cultures and different needs. Communication skills differ. And you need to be able to, one, pick up on what's required to succeed in this environment and modulate your behavior in such a way. He's not selling out. There's nothing about what he's doing in either context that's selling out. What he's doing, and I used to use this when I work with African-American boys, is he's got the hustle. That's the hustle. He is doing what needs to be done to succeed in that particular context. He's getting it done, so to speak. He's doing the hustle. And that, to me, is what we're not valuing and emphasizing and encouraging in African-American kids. Instead, we shame them for, quote unquote, talking like Richard Sherman does on the football field, assuming that that is always a negative or that is a key to not succeeding, or it's ghetto talk or hood talk, as opposed to looking at it as that's incredibly savvy. That's the language of his community or the community of his football players, that he is modulating it for connection.
Well, he becomes a leader on the team because he knows how to talk like a football player on the football. And he is one of the leaders, and they get it, and so he's communicating. But let me get back to that point you just made. You know, we're telling maybe young African-American men that there's something wrong with that. Well, in his case, there was. I mean, here it was. We do understand how football players talk. We understand the violence of the game, and trash talk is an intimate part of the game. And for some reason, when that man with his dreads hanging off his head and his black skins used those words and made those gestures, everybody had to comment on what should have been a kind of normal part of the game. So there is a double standard, isn't there?
Or for sure.
Is there?
The dialogue wasn't about what he did and how he said it wasn't inappropriate or incorrect in general. It was where he did it. It was the context. It was the fact that the microphone was in his mouth. And to be fair, you know, he didn't have his chance. We call it cultural frame shifting. Yeah. He didn't get in that mode. He was still in the moment. He was still in football mode. But so again, the message isn't that what he did was wrong. It was that it was inconsistent or incongruent with the situation or the context. And that's the thing. You know, the analogy I often use when I work with educators is like a school uniform. When we think about school uniforms, we don't tell children, well, we expect you to wear this after hours and on the weekends, and something's wrong with you if you don't. What we tell children is the school uniform symbolizes that in this building, this is the uniform for success in this building. But outside of this building, on the weekends and after school, no one expects you to use this as your standard. I would love it if we could have a dialogue in our country about seeing academic language as a uniform that in the walls of school or in professional, you know, atmospheres in the United States, this is the type of language, academic language. I don't say proper. I don't say mainstream. Mm-hmm. Again, academic language. This is appropriate for this setting. But I also use the term language of home, the language of community, that the language of home is appropriate for that setting. And so if we looked at the way kids talk as a uniform in a school, right, everyone has the same requirements and expectations in this building. Right. And we're not going to shame you if outside of the building that what is required for you to be successful and competent in your community is very different, is a dialect variation than some of your other
but
peers.
That does make it easier for some than others if in the dominant culture I don't have to switch, because that's pretty much the way it goes for me, whether I'm home, at work, or you know, or in an office, or somewhere else, or the store. But if I have different environments because I'm part of a minority culture, it sounds like I've got to do a little extra work. And if I miss, if I don't have the chance to switch, I'm going to be punished.
Without question. And one of the biggest issues I have is that we assume that everyone has access and exposure to academic language in the same way.
Right.
And so this notion of selling out and acting white, it has not been substantiated at all in the literature. And the reality is that there's this assumption that children are choosing to not switch without looking at how much access has this child had to even know how to switch. And that's, to me, the job that we need to do in schools, is to give them the tools and the accessible access. I've had parents say, well, what about TV? Yeah, and my kid becomes bilingual watching Dora. No, you don't learn it unless you're immersed in it.
Well, and getting back to your examples growing up, again, you had explicit cues. Don't you look me in the eye, young lady, you're mm-hmm. acting up, or whatever as your father said. On the other hand, your mother said, look me in the eye, you're not telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You were told explicitly. Unfortunately, in the outside culture, you're not told you're wrong. There is a bias. If you're on the street confronting a police officer, your black body might result in your death because that gesture was interpreted one way. In school, we've got all kinds of statistics about young black men who are being discriminated against in terms of the way they're punished. And again, a suggestion of implicit bias. Nobody tells you, but it's having a consequence. Now, how do we teach that?
Without question, our data shows that about 75% to 80% of in a high poverty elementary school in Durham, about 80% are very high in dialect variation. Of that, the large majority are young boys. When we look at as they go through elementary school, the black females are lowering their rates of variation. We're not seeing that the same way with black males. I think that the gender, the intersectionality is happening. I think black females in academic settings are getting more opportunities to work with the teacher, to have adult conversations, to be helpers, where, again, the gender and the intersectionality, the implicit biases, the boys are often out either on the playground around each other. And so the idea that they have even access and exposure is there's differential rates. So we're seeing that in terms of dialect variation, there is a gender effect that the black females, as they progress through school, are starting to acquire more academic language skills and rely less on their dialect variation, where this appears to maintain for the African-American boys, which I think is playing directly into what you're saying, is that the idea that I'm choosing not to code switch, which could be incredibly costly, especially if I'm not picking up on the cues that I may be, in fact, in a dangerous situation. And if the person I'm interacting with, the police officer, administrator, the principal, views me as being openly defiant or oppositional. because I'm not code switching.
Do we know the extent to which when minority cultures are part of a dominant culture, we assume that they brought over much of their sort of communication style from the place where they're the place of origin? How much is developed as a result of and in opposition to the dominant culture? Do we have any idea?
My data is showing that it's actually the opposite pattern. So people often blame motivation, right? So right. Black children don't want to sell out. They don't look like Uncle Toms or be called nerds. And the reality is there's been so much work, incredible work done by folks at UNC and at Duke. That's just not what's in the literature. What we find and what I find in our data is that it's the younger kids that have the highest variation, and that seems to be really related to their motivation. Now, no one would think that a kindergartner is purposely choosing to maintain his or her blackness. That's why I don't want to code switch. It's that after third grade, once they get that first end of grade test score and they get outside feedback and often even internal feedback that there's something wrong with the way they talk, we then see that their third grade scores actually predict their motivation in fourth grade. That now their third grade motivation does not predict their end of grades. What predicts end of grades in fourth grade is my third grade end of grade predicts my motivation, which then predicts.
But then if you think about it again, if you're misplaced or misjudged early on, then your third grade scores, the impact on those scores by having been misjudged or misunderstood could be profound. And the fix is already in.
Without question. And what we find, I think the most compelling finding, is that my third, fourth, and fifth graders, there is not a relationship between my motivation in school and how I do. The reason why is I can really like to read, but that doesn't translate into how well I do on my reading. That is very different than what we see with white children. And what's more important is this is not related to my dialect variation. So I think what happens is early on, black children see themselves and are told and get a lot of messages that they're less than because of the way they speak. As they get older and this notion of identity kicks in, I think what's happening is that they're actually disentangling it. My identity and how I speak is not related to my academics. So I can be black and I can talk the way I talk. And the reason why I don't do well in school isn't because of that. It's somehow because of this mismatch between the skills I have from home that I bring and how I'm tested and evaluated.
And if you were misplaced, and we've seen plenty of evidence. In fact, your colleague over at Duke, Sandy Darity, has plenty of evidence to suggest how students have been misplaced. They should be gifted and talented. If they're African-American, more likely to be misdiagnosed as LD, learning disabled, and therefore on the wrong track. From the get-go.
We see this the same with language variation. You either see an overrepresentation in language disorder, meaning anyone who speaks this way is labeled disordered, or an under, the idea that everyone speaks this African-American English, so it's not about disorder. And we actually pull them apart, and they have very different impacts on kids' outcomes.
Makiba Wilborn, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Makiba Wilborn is a psychology professor at Duke University, the leader of the Wilborn Infant Lab at Duke. And you can find out more about her work and anything we've talked about on our show at stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.